Welcome to the In Conversation with Expo Stars podcast. I am Lee Ali, founder and MD of Expo Stars Interactive, an award-winning global live marketing and exhibition engagement agency. This is a podcast about leading the way in the live marketing industry and in business. In every episode, we speak to people around the world who do absolutely amazing work. You'll find an eclectic mix of stories and valuable insights on audience engagement, sales and marketing, mindset and well-being, business growth, and much more. We've been active in the live marketing industry for well over a decade now, and over that time, we've been very fortunate and privileged to have met and worked with a diverse range of inspiring business people. We ask them thought-provoking questions and share with you their valuable insights. We want to inspire you to transform your live marketing, engage your audience, grow your business, and enjoy the process. Happy listening. Hello, everyone. Welcome again to episode number 7 of In Conversation with Expo Stars, with me, Lee Ali, the Managing Director of Expo Stars Interactive. Today, we're going to be talking to Larry Kulchewick from the US, and we're going to be talking about how the history of exhibitions and trade shows has changed over the last 50 years, and what we can actually learn from the last 50 years as we reach a critical point after COVID in the trade show industry. What I usually find is that when there is a critical point of change, we can actually learn a lot from the past in terms of how we actually move forward. And I thought it would be a really good conversation to have with somebody who's been in the trade show industry for the last 50 years. And I'm going to introduce you to my good friend, Larry Kulchewick from, is it Denver you're in right now, Larry?
Yes, Parker, Colorado to be exact, but very close to Denver.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on to our podcast today. Really excited to have you come and talk to us. So tell us a bit more about yourself in terms of your history. I always find that rather than me doing justice to introduce you, it's always better to have the guest tell us a bit more about themselves in their own words.
Well, I couldn't have picked a better time to retire, but I just can't stop thinking about what I did for the past 50 years. And I continue to ponder upon it, and I still write for Exhibit City News here in the United States. But my career started in 1971 when I graduated from Southern Illinois University with a degree in design, and my professor was Buckminster Fuller. Now, for many of you out there who don't know who Buckminster Fuller is, I'd ask you to WW him and find a little more, because he was the designer of the geodesic dome. He was a world thinker, wrote this book called Spaceship Earth, How We Can All Get Along in the World If We'd Only Share Our Resources. It took me 20 years to realize what he was talking about. Now, getting out of college, I designed what? A degree in design. I happened to be from Chicago and fumbled, like many of us in this industry have, into the business of exhibit design. So I was hired as an exhibit designer in 1971, the year that McCormick Place was actually rebuilt after it burned to the ground, which was a great opportunity for me. Everybody needed an exhibit because, yeah, well, at least for the houseware show, all the exhibits burned the night. And then 2 years later, they built McCormick Place, which went on to be the number one facility in the world. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is how our industry has evolved from the 60s to today. Each decade, something changed. Something drove the change. It just didn't happen. Yeah. And it'll change once again in a big way with our COVID.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be prouder of the time I spent in this industry. I was president of the Exhibit Designer and Producers Association, and then went on to be president of IFES, the International Federation of Exhibition Service, all the service contractors in the United States. We changed our bylaws to allow all of companies to be qualified to be members. There today are 45 countries that are members. And after being president, I wrote a book. And the book was How to Act Differently When You Go From One Country to the Next. The name of the book is Trade Shows from One Country to the Next. I would be remiss if I didn't mention it. So I know that's
of course,
not
yeah.
today. Of but course, in any yeah. case, any of you who are interested in this book, just get a hold of Lee or myself. I'd be glad to lend a hand. But from that book brought to mind all the differences that we have in the world and the way we go about a trade show, yeah. how we do it and what we do. More importantly, how we engage with, yeah. with the guests, not so much yeah. how we built the exhibits. Yeah. But what I'd like to do today is just share, coming from Chicago, I couldn't have been luckier to be in the epicenter of trade shows in the United States. And my talk today really focuses on the US. The evolution of trade shows really began 100 years ago plus in Europe and the rest of the world. We're doing this long before the US acknowledged that it was a worthy way of marketing your products and services. And it wasn't until 1950 or so that the US really got more serious about it. Major cities were the ones who hosted the shows. So with that, and upon retiring, I've been doing a lot of research about our industry. I wrote a paper about the history of EDPA and a paper about the history of IFAS. And if any of you out there are interested in that history, each association has a story.
Yeah.
And each story has a reason for why they are the way they are today. So I hope today to share what changed over 50 years in the United States and how and why.
Yeah, that's great. Seems like obviously you've been in the industry as long as I've actually been alive, which is amazing. And,
oh my gosh. And,
yeah, and another interesting thing that we have in common is that both our exhibition careers started in Chicago.
Wow.
What a fantastic city to actually have in common. So that's brilliant. So let's get into the conversation then. And I'm going to share my screen. So we're going to introduce some visuals here as well. So here we are. So we've got six decades actually that we're going to take a look at. And right. If you want to start us off in terms of looking at, I mean, we've had exhibitions in Europe since the Great Exhibition in Crystal Palace in London, 1851. And while I can only imagine, you know, the trade show models they actually had in 1851 and, you know, some of the tools that they actually used to promote the products and services and the innovations that they actually had in 1851. But obviously we've had, you know, our trade show industry in Europe has been very, very active. When did trade show events really kick into high gear in the US?
Well, it probably in the 50s, but in Europe, the world fairs really were the model. And yeah. There were world fairs all over the world, which kind of set the stage for showing your wares and goods face-to-face.
Yeah.
And that's really the basis of an industry, which today in the United States is $100 billion.
Yeah.
You know, I always say I fumbled into a secret industry. And as we all did, nobody out there, whoever's listening to this, tell me honestly, did you intend to be in this industry? The answer is no. You've found a way. And once you found it, you grow to love it, as I still do, even though I'm retired and I can't yeah. stop thinking about it. Yeah. But in 1950, I would say was when it began, and really in the major cities like New York, believe it or not, Atlantic City, New Jersey was a very famous starting point for exhibits, Chicago, Washington, DC. But trade shows really in the 1960s, and put on the next slide, Alec. Could you put the next slide on?
Yep. Let's have a look.
There you go. There you go. 60s. Yep. There we go.
Yeah.
Now, before 1960 and 1970, this picture is the very first AORN show. Now, you may notice a lot of women in the space. Now, in 16, not too many women attended trade shows. They were there, but you're seeing so many women because this is the operating room nurses show. Of course, there's women. And you see nuns because a lot of the hospitals were owned by Catholics or Protestant churches and such. But just looking at this was in the basement of in Washington, D.C. Look, there's no aisle carpets. Who are all of the exhibitors? They're all men. Yeah. There's no women who are behind that counter there. Yeah. They're all dressed in suits. They come to the party prepared. We used to go to get in an airplane dressed too back in the day. Today, people get on in their shorts. And in any case, that's...
So it was a very formal. So it was a very formal process, Larry. It's like very businesslike. We're going, and it's going to be a business conversation. And there wasn't really any kind of engagement or anything like that. It was, I'm here for business. Let's talk business, and that's it.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah, and it was. There were not as today. There are 13,000 trade shows in the United States, but back in the day, there by no means were as many. But most trade shows began with associations who helped them to organize it. Put on the next slide, and I think that could segue better. And this is in 1970, and it's really when I began, and it's when trade shows really kicked into high gear. And they kicked into high gear because McCormick Place burned and they built this huge facility that established Chicago as the epicenter in the United States for trade shows. Yeah. There also were other cities, Atlanta, Dallas, St. Louis, New York, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Philadelphia. Today, many of those are not players like they were back in the day. Now, in 1970, going to a trade show was somewhat of a party. It was, I'm going to the convention. And there were a lot of insinuations with the word convention, meaning that you're going there to play and network, of course. Yeah. But in those early days, the exhibits were all made out of wood. They were all very heavy. And at that point, it didn't matter because drayage was not the word yet. Everybody had brought tons of literature to hand out. And in shows like the auto show, females were really part of the attraction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of houseware show, hardware show, they would have females handing out the literature as a form of attraction to come talk to me, just kind of bizarre. And of course, the pipe and drape concept, see in the picture, nowhere but in the United States do we do this. And it was started back in the 70s when show contractors became involved.
Yeah, just going back to the auto show woman, the picture that we see there, is that the first instance at the auto shows where they actually use females as promotion, as a promotional tool?
I can't say it's the first because this particular auto show was in the new McCormick Place, and the old McCormick Place had auto show as well as New York City, Los Angeles, and other cities that had auto shows. And they all kind of copied each other's methodology and the use of attractive presenters. And the gals would just stand on stage and didn't even talk. Right. Today, they're presenters, and they're not dressed like that. Yeah, so it's a totally changing world.
And at what point was it, you know, taking a trade show to a major city, what point did it become tourism industry related? What point did cities start to say, well, this is how we can boost our tourism by actually having all of these industry trade shows come to our city? When did the actual, the city governments decide, right, we're going to play an active role into bringing major shows to their cities?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think McCormick Place, but when it was rebuilt and it was bigger than any other, many other cities took notice to the point where they could increase their tourism and today to the city of Chicago, the trade shows contribute $6 billion in revenue to the city.
Yeah.
Now multiply that times other cities and the view that building a center will allow people to come to see the city, that the excuse was the trade show and the city happened to be. Now you had to have an airport that accommodated guests from around the world. And there were many requirements. You had enough hotels, enough restaurants to accommodate this. And it became a trend where cities were investing in building trade show convention centers. And it really kicked into gear in the 80s more so than in the 70s. But in the 70s is where it started. But I want to bring up one point and something that happened in probably the 60s and 70s. And this is where the American model of organizing a trade show began. What I mean by the American model, it's not the same as organizing a show in Europe or in Asia.
Yeah.
In the United States, it started with an association or a group who then decided we're going to have a fair, a convention, whatever. And they would select a location in the US, and then they would select a show contractor, a show organizer. Those are two different people now. Yeah. The organizer would help them to select a site, help them with hotel accommodations, things of this nature. But the show contractor was brought in to lay out the show floor and provide services at that particular facility. Now, these facilities only provided space. They didn't have any other services. So somebody had to do this. Somebody had to provide the electrical service, the carpenter service, the material handling, forklifts and such. And this is where contractors began to play a role to be a necessary component in organizing a trade show. And today, there's not a show in the US that a show contractor isn't involved.
Yeah.
And I've had so many conversations with my European friends when coming to a show here. Larry, why do I have to use these union guys? And what do you mean I got to pay for my freight by the pound? I don't understand this. It's not fair. I said, please, time out. You're absolutely right. It isn't fair. It's not right. But it is what it is. And until it changes, let's make it less painful.
Yeah. It's a vital component.
And I'm not defending the system. I think it stinks, but we've had it going this long and it's remarkably difficult to change at this point. It really is.
Yeah. Can anything drive it to change? Is there anything in particular out there that will actually make it change? Is it just an uncomfortable truth that everyone is living with and they're just letting it lie because it just is, it's just the way that it is? Or is there anything that can actually force the model to actually change over the next few years?
I believe the thing that can change the model would be the exhibitors revolting.
Right, okay.
We're not going to have it this way. We want it another way.
Yeah.
But the real dilemma is not the exhibitors, but it's the associations.
Right.
They are not going to volunteer to say, I'll pay my own, because here's what a show contractor provides. They bid to win the job. Hey, I'm going to have a show in Philadelphia, whatever. And GES, Freeman, and in those days, there were quite a few show contractors beside those two big guys. Yeah. But you go to a show contract, the one who wins began to promise, I will provide you with registration counters when the people come in. I'll provide aisle identification signs. I'll provide an entry archway, a welcome walkway through. I'll provide aisle carpet. All these things they're providing for free to get the job. Well, how did they pay for those free things? They paid for those free things by drayage, rental carpets, rental furniture, and the labor on the show floor. Yeah. Now, in those days, they provided all those things. There weren't independent I&D companies at this time. There weren't carpet companies. There weren't furniture companies. And I'll get into that in the next decade, because that's when that changed. But why would you volunteer to say, look, I don't want all those things. Please charge me for what you're going to provide only. So it's very difficult to change something when something is offered so freely.
Yeah, yeah.
And believe it or not, associations make a lot of money off shows that they put on.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And it's not something that's spoken because that's their major fundraising event.
Of course.
Every industry.
Yeah. So for our Larry, for our European listeners, could you just again explain what drayage is and just so that when people are coming over to the US to exhibit, they understand exactly what they're actually getting themselves into? Because I found it really confusing when I did my first exhibit at Exhibit Alive, and there was all these charges that I actually hadn't accounted for, because I was thinking, well, it would be the same as Europe. So, but then I started getting all of these extra charges. So if you could just explain that briefly for us, that would be great.
A major error in assuming that it would be the same in cost, let alone unions or whatever. But of all people from the UK know the word drayage. It's really a horse that's draying a wagon, and they would unload the ships and take them to a holding port.
Yeah.
So it's unloading the ship, taking freight to the holding port, the trade show center or whatever.
Okay.
And that concept became something to be charged by the pound versus by hours and such.
Yeah.
So $75 per hundredweight. They charge by 100 weight. Now it's like in the hundreds per hundredweight, whatever.
Right.
Because of that change, people didn't moan and groan because they didn't pay so much for drayage in the beginning.
Right.
Because in the beginning, the GESs, Freemans, and all the shepherds and show contractors, they had all of the carpet income, they had all of the labor. You had to use their labor, they would provide it. They had all the furniture. They had all these other ways of making money beside drayage. Now, as time went on, those components got away from them. And we'll talk about that happened in the next century where they lost all of that component revenue. So where are they going to make it up?
Yeah.
In drayage. So the cost of this drayage increased during this period to the point where today it's just such it's an expensive component of budgeting for the show.
Yeah.
So it's going to change that too. When the exhibitors scream loud enough, but it's the associations who are going to have a hard time to say, charge me what, take those things out and charge me for them, because their profit level at that point would diminish a little bit.
Yeah. Is this a cost that the unions control, or is it more of the show organizers and the association?
No, it's up to the city. And the cities who have had the strongest union influence, New York City, Chicago, Boston, guess what? They're the cities who lost out in being number one.
Yeah.
In the beginning, New York was one of the top cities. Chicago was number one for a very long time. But unions chipped away, and the people decide they're not going to pay this much for labor or other components. So at that point, Las Vegas and Orlando weren't even a player. Mm-hmm. They weren't on the chart of the top cities to go to. But today, 8 out of 10 exhibitors who have 10 shows, their shows are either in Chicago, Orlando, or Las Vegas, and more likely Orlando and Las Vegas. So Chicago lost its seat at the top because of union costs and pressures. It was easier to do business in Las Vegas and in Orlando. But guess what? In Las Vegas, a lot of people from Chicago moved to Las Vegas. So they brought with them their Chicago mentality or whatever. So Las Vegas isn't even as cheap as it was to begin with.
Okay, what would you say was the key innovation then in the 1970s that actually affected the trade show industry? positively or negatively?
I think that at that point, the exhibit was the attraction. And the exhibit allowed you to show your wares, and it was like a set. Now, today, we don't care about the exhibit. It's like we don't care about a TV set. Do you ever hear anybody say, what a wonderful TV set that was? No, it's a given. It better be sharp and effective and draw your attention to the people and what the people have to say. So on those days, the exhibit played a stronger role than anything in terms of attracting people to your space. It was your billboard to define your greatness.
Yeah.
So I read the billboard.
So moving on to the 1980s, you mentioned before that during this period, we actually had a lot more suppliers come into the marketplace and actually influence the exhibition industry.
Absolutely. Now, this was a very interesting period. This is when specialization companies kicked in. Freight companies dedicated themselves to trade show movement, IND, installation and dismantling. In the US, and I believe it's one of the only countries that have these independent installation carpenters that will set up and take down your exhibit. And that boomed. Furniture companies came into the marketplace. The furniture that GS and Freeman used to provide was junk, and that's all you can get. But then new companies came forth with stylish furniture. They'd have to ship it in, but it sure gave your exhibit a bit of a spiff up. And remember, the exhibit itself was still an important component of the whole visual. Also in those days were floral companies that outside of the show center, and the concept of show badges and getting what do they call it? Imprinters and such.
Yeah.
Now the show contractor used to provide those, but then outside companies came in and provided these things. So the unions and the show organization model all kicked in big time, and it was still exhibits about architecture, as opposed to exhibits about results and engagement and what your company's all about, Lee. About this piece, but this piece really carved a very important component to your participation. If you came to the show with the draped back wall and a cardboard sign, you weren't taken seriously enough. You're saying, boy, look at all the money I saved. I just got a cardboard sign and I got a table. My people will do the rest. Well, I'm sorry, that is not going to cut it. In fact, I won't even cut it today. I don't care how good a pitch you have. If you don't have some architecture or something behind you that kind of insinuates your seriousness, I think you will fail.
Is this where the design mentality, the kind of build it and they will actually come? Do you think this is where it really was set in stone, with the visualization of the booth and the company and all the color schemes and the designs? Is this where companies started thinking, well, if we build it big and we build it bright and colorful, people will come along and we will get a chance to talk to them?
That's a good point, because it was that way in the early 80s and such.
Yeah.
And there was a guy in the US by the name of Fred Kitzing, and I'll pitch Fred. He had a company in Chicago, Kitzing Incorporated, and he pitched that you have to develop an attraction within the space.
Yeah.
Not the architecture, but there's got to be an attraction in addition to the architecture that allows people to come in and begin to tell your story. See, we in the United States have a way of kicking into our sales pitch before you even get to know someone. And the rest of the world is not like that. Yeah. But we still act that way. And I say we, and I say that respectively. I am an American, and the book I wrote is from an American point of view. Right. But nevertheless, that kind of attitude needs to be we have to be aware of it. Don't kick into your pitch immediately. Yeah. And we still kind of do that, but the Fred's mentality was the exhibit is second to the attraction. And right, part of that attraction was the people within it and some form of a gimmick in it, in a way, that whether it be a magician or a live presentation, that was the attraction. And that started a new trend.
Yeah. Well, did Disney have anything to do, do you think, in terms of creating that experience with a gimmick and having a story to tell?
Yeah.
Because I think, thinking back, Disney World and the Disney parks, they became prominent during that period.
Yeah, and I would think their influence kicked in the higher gear in the 90s to 2000, although they played a role because we all at that 1989 went to Disneyland or Disney World at one point, maybe with our family. And that experience, and that's really the word experience, is what trade shows tried to emulate. Let's go to the next slide. And I think this is where that kind of thinking began to change.
Oops. Yeah. Oops.
So
there we are.
There you go. 1990. Some major stuff changed in 1990. And it was financial. We had a crisis. And everybody enjoyed going to trade shows. Nobody would say that it's not a valuable marketing tool. But they said, my gosh, the money we have to spend to go there. Well, we can't afford to do this. Yeah. And CEOs, CFOs began to have their two cents in companies to say, we really need to spend this much money. But at that point, something drastic happened. And the industry, in their creative way, and believe it or not, many of the people in our industry are extremely creative, but how can we do more with less? So what happened? We developed portable exhibits. We developed systems that were lightweight systems that were like Tinker Toys, Lincoln Logs, that you can reconfigure in different sizes and shape. Fabric, we built exhibits out of fabric and lighter weight stuff. All of these things contributed to reduce one thing, and that's the cost of drayage. They were light, they didn't weigh as much, so my cost to install the labor and the cost for weight was decreased drastically by these. Now, when they first come on the market, many exhibit companies, including the one I worked for, which at that time was the largest exhibit company in the world. It was owned by the Greyhound Corporation. It's called Exhibit Group. They had 18 different divisions. And our president said, we don't need all these portable Tinker Toy exhibits. We make real exhibits. What a short-sighted. We should have bought a systems company, a portable company, because that's where the market was going.
Right.
They cared about architecture, but they didn't care how sturdy it was, as long as it looked the part and it was still presenting a professional opinion. But what also happened in 1990 and 2000 was the internet.
Yeah.
And not only the internet, but the use of audiovisual within exhibit space. Television monitors and served to be the visual aid for helping to make a presentation, to help explain your product and service. It also eliminated people from bringing huge equipment in.
Yeah.
You can show it on the video screen. They can show, here's how my machine operates or my medical device works. And that really helped big time because a lot of this stuff used to be shown in person and it became very expensive, especially if you had heavy equipment, which was charged by the weight. So the 1990-2000, in my opinion, was if there was changes, this was the mega change. And the way the exhibits were just these background structures. They weren't the end all. And the beginning of presentations using technology and the use of computers. Now, in these early days, you'd have to pay for telephone hookup. You'd have to pay for internet, and it wasn't cheap.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. In fact, you'd have to pay, electricians were the ones that had to hook up the internet line. And Jesus, where's that guy at? I need my connectivity. And it began a way to take your leads from the show and then transmit them back to your home office instantly. Yeah. It really changed things. So, but it was in the next year, go ahead and change the slide, where the big change really kind of kicked in.
Is it 1990? Yeah, it was 2000. Yeah, right. This decade, yeah.
Yeah. Now, at this point, we in the U.S. and companies believe trade shows work. They do generate some opportunities and income and such, but we can't have these outrageous costs, and we got to be smarter about how we go about doing it. So at this point, we're using both heavy exhibits, lightweight exhibits, and technology all together. Now, when it comes to shows like the auto show or big spaces, these lightweight exhibits can't do what wood and steel can do. Yeah. So wood and steel still had their place for the big shows and the big structures and such. But really, I'd say 50% was lightweight and other alternatives. But it was at this point, because trade shows mean business, that we became very serious about how do we measure the return on this investment? Yeah. How do we better use this tool to tell our CFOs that, hey, it is, let me show you how much we got as a result of this $200,000 investment or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it was at this point that I mentioned Fred Kitzing, but his wife, Lene Kitzing, started a concept, integrated marketing, and she came up with the point of view that there are seven components to marketing, of which trade shows are one. Not one or any other is more important. They all work together, but trade shows were the most expensive component on this pie chart of seven. And the rule of thumb with how much money do we put aside for marketing, rule of thumb is 5% of your revenue. So you put aside 5%, and between in that 5% of dollars or whatever, you then divide where you're going to spend that money. Now, trade shows used to be more than a third of the total expenses. And what's happening now is electronic technology and digital is biting into that budget big time. Yeah. It's that 5% rule is still valid.
Yeah.
But I question those who put a 5% away last year probably have money left over.
Because
they didn't need to spend it, so they got it. And we'll see how that changes.
Is this where, would you say that in the early 2000s, in the early noughties, that this is where the need for education came along, or was that much earlier in terms of needing to, along with the engagement process, actually wanting to educate the attendees and using that as an engagement tool?
Yeah, I'd say 2000 is when it started. Now, Lee, what you mentioned that show you had, your first one in Chicago. What, you remember what year that was?
Yeah, that was 2007. That was AdTech in Chicago, which was advertising technology, yeah.
Yeah, and at that point, did you have your engagement hat on or mentality?
Yeah, at that time... I didn't actually know a lot about engagement at all, because all I knew that we had to take a portable exhibit that we took from the UK. Obviously, I'd done other trade shows, but it was all about the conversational piece, getting in front of people and trying to get them engaged in a conversation, and then obviously demonstrating and presenting your products. So it wasn't really, we never really thought about, I mean, I did exhibitions between 2002 and 2007 in my telecoms career, but it was always with the viewpoint of building relationships, not educating people.
Yeah, because I think you mentioned 2007, but it probably was maybe 2003, 5, whatever, that it really kicked into higher gear about the measurement and also engagement.
Yeah.
sit-down versus stand-up presentations kind of thing, yeah. One-on-one. And that's truly the magic and the value of trade shows, period. And I always said the magic of trade shows is the element of emotion.
Yeah.
And there's no other media that captures emotion as well as face-to-face.
Yeah.
And that's the that's what makes it work.
Yeah.
And now we have a challenge coming up, and we'll get into the post-COVID, because when we're wearing masks, we're not seeing that nice toothy smile.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. We'll talk yeah. about that.
Yeah.
But so, and then 2010 came along, and the whole concept still was engagement, but it was now about the experience. It had to be an experiential. Now you talk about Disney.
Yeah.
That was an experience. And this kind of mimicked the Disney way in a lot of ways. Yeah. I remember back in 1990s or whatever, when we developed lightweight exhibits and we cut down drayage. But lo and behold, what did we do? We then began using theatrical lighting. That truss yeah. work and all that stuff up there ain't light. And it isn't cheap. But yeah. we somehow rationalized that that was a necessary component to making this theatrical experience more fulfilling.
Yeah, I think one of the big things was actually grabbing the fight for attention, because you actually have the lights, you have the technology, you have all of the different designs. And so it becomes a battle for eyeballs, doesn't it? When you have a room full of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 people, how do you grab that attention?
No, you're absolutely right. And the bigger the company, the more impact they need to show.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine Apple Computer with a little portable exhibit at a show saying, we just wanted to be here. Yeah. You're better off not being there if you're going to look the part yeah. of somebody who's on a budget, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need to look that magical, special company in order to attract.
I think it's the need to stand out from your competitors, isn't it? It's and I think you see this quite a lot, especially in the Middle East. It's who's the brightest, who's the loudest, and who's basically a case of showing who's got the most money, really.
Well, look at the city of Dubai and who's got the nicest buildings. Gosh.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the same,
too, I guess.
It's the same approach with exhibitions there as well.
Now, the other major thing that happened 2010-20, and this is a big one, and that's the use of technology, smartphones.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, we're using this new tool in addition to the exhibit and supplementing the TV monitors in many ways. But the attraction, in my opinion, became somewhat of a distraction. I mean, you look at the picture, this is a very common thing that people aren't even looking at you and they're looking at their computer monitor, and it's the new world we live in, and it's even enhanced through COVID, because you even notice if you're on a Zoom call and you look at the people who are on that call, half of them are looking at their smartphone.
Yeah.
We've dismissed eye contact as being an important part of a meeting or communication.
Yeah.
And it seems to be, it's okay. But on the flip side, it certainly has helped to invite people to a space.
Yeah.
To tell me more about your product and service. Nobody has literature anymore. They literally get all the literature they need right off their smartphone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, obviously, that's actually helped reduce the carbon footprint of exhibitions as well. I think technology has had a big role to play in that.
Well, and the World Wide Web, of course, which, you know, you want to know something. I find with my wife, I'll ask her a question and she dial it on the web. Here's the answer.
Yeah.
instant communication. And that's why I believe it's so important that with all this technology, that the human element must continue to be an important component of effective communication.
Yeah.
And our ability to make eye contact and engage in such a way that I make a decision on an emotional basis.
Yeah.
And many of us do.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think on a human level, it is an emotional connection that you build when you go through an experience. But I have a question for you in that. Do you think that a lot of companies use technology for the sake of using technology because it was the in thing in the early 2000s with the onset of, virtual reality and all of this? Do you think a lot of companies just used for the sake of it to be seen to be relevant? Or do you think it was an innovation that was actually needed?
I think it's not a gimmick. And if the people from within an exhibitor, company, whatever, don't believe that it's a useful tool, it's not going to be a useful tool. So yeah, today we have exhibit designers who do more than just design the structure. They're helping to design where people are going to walk, what the message is going to be, and the technology that they recommend that you use to pull this all together. Now, if the exhibitors don't buy into that technology, then it's not going to happen. So it's not a gimmick, it's a tool. And that tool has to be useful to enhance what you would have gotten otherwise, especially the whole concept of lead follow-up, which is a whole conversation in itself about how it doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to the current times then. In terms of where we are today, with looking at towards the next decade. You've got a really good slide here, looking at what is the norm in the world of exhibitions moving forward, and there's a lot of interesting stuff on there.
Well, this whole concept of COVID really changed the world, and none of us saw it coming. Lee, you see me okay? My screen just changed off.
Yep, I can still see you.
Because my emails are on the screen.
Oh, that's strange.
You don't see them, right?
No.
Okay, good. In any case, this whole COVID thing changed the world. And it really changed the way we think about trade shows and face-to-face. And it forced us to start acting differently when it came to health and safety and such. And we're still struggling through it. And I'm so happy to see that many shows in the world, not in the United States as quickly, are coming back, but they're coming back slowly, cautiously, and smaller.
Yeah.
And smarter.
Yeah.
And many companies are still not allowing their companies to allow their employees to get on an airplane and go stay in a hotel or whatever. Or if they're going to an event that's coming up, instead of sending 10 people, they're only going to send 5 people. They're reducing, not because they are trying to save money, but they're still walking cautiously. And we're going forward with this thing with caution. And one of the things I'm seeing, I don't know about how it is in the UK, but today in the United States, and it happened just in the last couple of weeks, where the whole concept of wearing masks seemed to be okay not to wear it.
Yeah.
And restaurants are opening, even going into grocery stores, half the people are wearing masks, half are not. So I'm curious, is this going to continue to the point where we're going to be back to masklessness, which I hope is the case, because when it comes to face-to-face communication, seeing the other's teeth, I think that plays a real important role.
Maybe absolutely. Absolutely.
The smile is not cool, but it is an important part. And so, but we're going to take with us some of the cautiousness and continue to be health-minded in a lot of ways, which is not bad. And I believe the technology will even play a stronger role. All of what we kind of gotten used to, but many of you out there don't feel that a digital or a trade show alternative is the right way to go.
Yeah,
we did it because we had to. There were no other, there were no shows, there were no other way to communicate. Zoom, as clumsy as it's used, and it's still pretty clumsy in my opinion, we've gotten used to it. And it's okay. But what it's done now, it's allowed us to have a better upfront feel about the company and the people we're going to do business with when we finally see them in person.
Yeah.
We're not going to be there and say, well, what do you do? Well, I already know what you do. Now tell me about this X, Y, Z and how it's going to save me money. That's great. It enhances the effectiveness of the face-to-face product. And maybe we don't need 10 people. The five people.
Absolutely. I think what you said earlier, the two words really stand out for me, and that is smaller and smarter, because I think that's the way, because I think the days of, you know, the 200,000 visitors or the 110,000 visitors that we sometimes see in cities like Barcelona, London, and even in Las Vegas, I think they're probably a thing of the past. And what you're going to see is a lot more regionalized events and much smaller. But I think from an exhibitor point of view, they've got to adapt their marketing strategy now where it's a 365-day experience rather than a four-day experience.
Right. You know, one of the components, and to touch upon what you just pointed out, in the 2010-2020 that I didn't mention, and that's the American mentality toward being international.
Yeah.
It wasn't until 2012 that we companies in the U.S. Embraced international trade shows and really used them. And wow, that it boomed. And this was before COVID, of course, that we were now becoming world marketplaces. There are shows in the world that are the shows. The Consumer Electronics Show, for example, is now in Las Vegas. I would say in the near future, it'll be in Singapore or it'll be in another port. It doesn't have to stay in the U.S. just because that's where.
They already have an international version in Shanghai, I guess. So, I think.
But there's going to be these mega shows that are the shows for medical industry, technology, wherever, aerospace. And the international participation has got to be, and we're going to blend to borrow pages from each other's book that I mentioned about the American model. Believe it or not, there will be companies that bring that American model to shows in the UK, to shows in Dubai, Paris. If the show organizer feels strongly that this is a better way to manage the show, then they will do it. And but it'll be a blending. It's not going to be a either or. Yeah. And we're all going to begin to start using the tool in a similar way. It's not going to be that my book will not be needed, quite frankly.
Right.
Which talks about differences in every kind, and there's major differences, believe me. But in time, it's going to be pretty much the same. And those differences are going to be a Reader's Digest version of the book.
Brilliant. What would you say is the way forward for organizers and exhibitors to actually collaborate and actually work together to create that experience? Because one of the things I've always been critical about is organizers just looking at the short-term picture in selling the floor space and not actually looking at what value the exhibitors can actually add to the whole show experience.
Now, that's an excellent point. And definitely show organizers and even the associations who launch these shows really need to pay attention to what are my participants who are paying good money getting out of it. And how can I help them get more out of it? What should I allow to happen? There was the CISO, which is a Society for Independent Show Organizers. They had their show in Florida a month ago. And one of the comments I heard was that we tried to jam too many bits of information, one on top of the other. People needed time to network. Yeah. They needed time to just talk casually to each other, which truly is one of the more powerful reasons why you go to a trade show in the first place. It's not the exhibit. Yeah. It's not the educational tool. Well, if you're in the medical industry, you're there probably to get your continued education units because you have to, but it's networking and its ability to share one-on-one as you would with your neighbor. I can't tell you how many people decide to buy a new car based on the recommendation their neighbor told him.
Of course.
You know, I've had this Honda for years and it really treated me well. So I'm buying a Honda because of that person I trusted.
Yeah. So just closing off then in terms of, you know, I think the key point about you, there's a quotation here. You've said, we do not think ourselves into new ways to design, but design with a new way of thinking. Do you want to explain that a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, you really, we think we can design our way out of conflicts and challenges as they come. Well, it's not what we do to design, but it's the way we think. Yeah. And I remember when CAD first came on the marketplace, computer-aided design, that of which all exhibits all of a sudden were designed on the computer. And people would buy the pretty picture instead of the content of that design, which was a shame because, and in fact, this is when I decided to change from being a designer and I got into management and was president of the exhibit group and was the biggest mistake I made. I really should have stayed a designer. But I didn't want to take the time to learn how to do CAD. I was drawing by hand, magic markers and such. Shame on me. Because if I didn't force myself to think this new way and learn this new way, I deprived myself from being able to go on to do what I've always loved to do, and that's design. Yeah. As opposed to being, I don't have an MBA, and here I was president of a company. Who am I kidding? Yeah, that was not my strength. But great. Your ego is the best of you.
To wrap up then, what would you say is the biggest thing that we can learn from the last 50 years that will actually help our industry to actually move upwards and onwards and get away from this COVID situation?
Yeah, I think it's results in some form. Really, we're not doing this for a party. Obviously, in the 60s and 70s, that was the attraction, the party. And then in the 70s, 80s, it was the exhibit. And boy, what a beautiful exhibit. And then let's make them lighter. So we evolved to the point where results are really important. And the power of face-to-face communication has to be challenged and continue to build upon. Because that's what trade shows are all about. It's face-to-face communication. What other things could we do to enhance that ability? Not just, boy, it felt good, but it's got to do something beyond just feeling good. It's got to, what's the next point where you're to buy? And then add to that the international component to understanding what's different in a different country, because there are still major differences culturally beside trade show rules and regulations. So as we go forward, it's as we step into a new marketplace, take the time to understand it and take the time to learn its idiosyncrasies. What is it that's unique about it? And what is it that I have to do to adapt to it better? Because you just don't adapt the same. I find that, you know, there are companies like IBM, for example. They can go into any, the food show, the auto show, whatever, and IBM could have an exhibit that talks to what their computers could do for that marketplace. But if they don't change their thinking about what is important to that industry's culture, their way of thinking, they're liable to lose an opportunity because they're just thinking about their computer as opposed to about what does this user need from me that's different.
Absolutely.
And the ability to open your mind to say, I admit I don't know what I don't know. And it's not admitting that is a mistake.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for summarizing that. I think those are very wise words to end our conversation on. It's been absolutely amazing to have you on our podcast, Larry. And thank you again for all your history, really, and your experience, sharing your experience. And I think I always value that. So thank you very much. And there you have it, the great Larry Kulchewicz. So I hope you really enjoyed the podcast and look out for the next In Conversation With coming soon. Thank you very much. And goodbye. Thank you very much, Larry. I wish you all the best, and we'll talk soon, no doubt.
And I wish all you out there success, and keep your both eyes open at all times. It's a wonderful industry. I couldn't be prouder to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Larry. Bye-bye.